You're listening to a news report podcast from thebodypro.com, the HIV resource for healthcare professionals.
I'm Miles Helford, editorial director of thebodypro.com. Poor antiretroviral adherence is widely regarded as a leading cause of HIV treatment failure and the development of drug resistance. This we know. What we're less clear on is the precise level of adherence that a patient needs to observe in order to ensure treatment success. And honestly, even that may be beside the point. Adherence, after all, is one of the most important end results of a complex interplay of factors affecting our patients, including the very nature of the HIV care they receive. To better flesh out the importance of adherence in HIV care today, as well as the steps healthcare providers can take to increase the likelihood of treatment success in their patients, I spoke by phone with Dr. Benjamin Young. Dr. Young is the Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of IAPAC, the International Association of Providers of AIDS Care, as well as an adjunct professor at the Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver and an assistant clinical professor of medicine at the University of Colorado. In light of the evolution of HIV care and antiretroviral development, particularly over the course of the past 5, 10, even 15 years, greater potency of the antiretrovirals we have available. In the U.S., we have, for the most part, a trend of decreasing, not increasing, HIV drug resistance. How important is adherence at all in the context of HIV care in the U.S. today?
So I think that this is a really important observation and question. So medications over the last 15 years have consistently and persistently improved better side effects, lower doses, lower numbers of pills, and perhaps more importantly, even in with some of the more current regimens, less drug resistance. And as you said, this has some important implications for pill taking and pill taking adherence. I think the short answer is that I think that medications have gotten better, and the frailty of those regimens over less than perfect adherence is less. So that is to say, drug regimens are better and stronger and less likely to produce treatment failure and treatment failure with drug resistance. You know, I think every provider is uncomfortable saying, you know, go ahead and miss a few doses of pills. I think our need to berate and sort of stigmatize people for being less than perfect is less key than it was, let's say, 5 or 10 years ago.
But it still matters?
Yeah, of course. You know, missing life-saving medications is probably not the best thing, right? I mean, that's stating the obvious, but I think that our margin of error now, the acceptability of a margin of error, is greater or better than it was before.
So let's get into that a little bit. The traditional benchmark for optimal adherence has been 95%. Your suggestion, then, is that maybe that's no longer the case? Maybe it's lower?
I think it is. I mean, one should remember that the 95% number, really the 95% mantra, was generated by a study that was conducted in the early 2000s. Actually, really, it started in the late 1990s. And that was a time when regimens were much more complex, more doses, shorter half-life of drugs, more side effects, and so on. In other words, regimens that really had a smaller margin of error, if you will. And that number has stuck like a tattoo to our mind's eye when we think about adherence and when we talk to people living with HIV about their adherence. And there have been a number of well-designed studies since that suggest that the actual statistical number that we need, that one can look at in study groups. In other words, what you're really asking is, can you compare one study group to another? And is there a statistical difference in their virologic suppression? And when you do that, those numbers actually aren't 95%. In fact, with some of the modern regimens, the number is lower. And again, it's almost like we're speaking heresy when we say it might be 90% or 85%. Oh, my God, even 80%, 80% might be good enough. I don't think that anyone is saying that it's okay to miss, it's a good idea to miss 1 in 5 doses. But I think that it gives us an opportunity to change the dialogue and the language we have with patients about times when they may be a little more human, a little less than perfect.
What do you mean by change the dialogue?
Well, I think too often patients are, one, afraid to admit their shortcomings. So, for example, if I had taken care of a patient and I'd been hammering them about the 95% number, and they come in and they're like, for the last week they missed you know, they missed a bunch of doses. And maybe their calculated number might be 80%. And rather than saying you need to stop your treatment until you can get your act together, we could say, well, let's look at what's going on. Let's see how we can improve that and ensure that the overall risk of failure is lower, and what are the interventions that we might entertain to do that.
Well, how can a clinician even really know whether a patient is adhering or not? I mean, is it just a matter of that relatively infrequent, at this point, viral load monitoring that, you know, you see maybe a blip and you ask that question? Or are you regularly checking in, or should you be regularly checking in with a patient to make sure that they're taking their drugs?
Well, I think that the answer is more the latter. In fact, I think that by the time you have a virologic detectable viral load, the horse is out of the barn, or in this case, the virus is out of the cell, if you will. And so it turns out that monitoring for adherence should happen at multiple levels in the healthcare system. So it's not just a dialogue that happens between patient and doctor. It could be a dialogue that happens between patient and case manager, or patient and pharmacist, or patient and support team member, and so on. And it should happen at some level at most encounters. I'm sure we'll touch on this later, but you know, our association published evidence-based guidelines around adherence to medications and care. And really, one of the most strongly rated recommendations was that we should actually ask about adherence to patients, self-reported adherence, routinely in all patients. And so this means that we should be asking people about how do they take their pills, understanding that there's reporting bias and error. But the people who are having difficulty will tell you, at least some of them will, and that's a reason to act on. And conversely, even people who are doing well, should be an opportunity to reinforce good behaviors.
Yeah, this sounds like it's going far beyond our traditional understanding of what adherence is all about, just about, hey, make sure you take your meds.
Right, and it's important because, in fact, there are some studies that suggest that you know, poor adherence in those self-reported reports actually eventually predicts virologic failure, even if the viral load is suppressed at the time of that inquiry. So again, viral breakthrough is not a leading edge predictor of subsequent failure. It's a late marker. And so what we want to be doing is being ahead of the curve and trying to do something about it before there's a problem.
What are the steps that a clinician can even take to be on top of a person's adherence? I mean, is this literally just a matter of the healthcare provider or the case manager or some combination thereof having this regular schedule where they check in and just directly ask a person whether they take meds?
There are lots of other interventions, and I think it distills back to this idea of individualizing care, and in other words, understanding who the individual is. So at one level, understanding what their frailties are, their risks are. People, for example, who have housing and food security problems, people who have mental health problems, those are people who may be at greater risk. Doesn't mean that they are having problems per se, but understanding people, you know, we need to know the warning signs so that we can offer, let's say, assess, and then, if necessary, offer greater degrees of support. Pharmacy refill information is critically important, and it's right in front of us. We get that information, or can get that information, but don't. Or, you know, the pharmacies can provide that information, but don't often communicate it well down the totem pole of care providers. So, you know, making sure that information is communicated not just to the prescriber, but perhaps to case managers, perhaps to other members of the healthcare team, can provide an opportunity for assessment and decision making long before the patients get into a lot of difficulty.
Whose responsibility is it?
The answer to that is a very organic one. It depends on what the structure of the care team looks like, and so that differs from community to community. At a minimum, it's the care provider and the patient, but I think it's an opportunity to strengthen the communications across the care team. Again, sometimes that's housed in one place, sometimes it's not. In our community in Denver, it's actually housed in multiple places, and so it can be a challenge to try to coordinate information about potential warning sign between, on adherence, trying to coordinate that between a pharmacist, a case manager, a prescriber, and the patient. But making sure that some sort of dialogue happens around that, I think, is important. And strengthening those communication ties, I think, is an opportunity to make this work better for people.
Is that realistic? I mean, in the context of where we are with healthcare funding and the general fragmented nature of, I think, HIV care as a whole at the moment, I mean, you do have exactly what you just described, a situation where, you know, let's say a person is going to a regional clinic to see their doctor or the nurse practitioner or whomever, and that's where they get, you know, labs done, that's where they have, you know, their 3-monthly check-in, that's where the doc who initially prescribes, they've got a case manager at a community-based organization, maybe nearby, maybe not so nearby, that checks in with them periodically just to see how they're doing, and then they go to Walgreens to actually fill the prescription, where there's a lot of places there. Number one, there's a lot of places where efforts to keep track of the patient and make sure that they're okay and that they're taking their meds and that everything is going all right with them, there's a lot of potential for cracks where that effort can fall through. But there's also, on the flip side, if everybody is taking individual responsibility for staying on top of care and ensuring patient adherence, there's potential for a lot of overlap that could end up pissing a patient off.
Again, I think this, you know, is a story that requires an individualized tuning of messages and the messengers. Your first point, yeah, it's important to understand that we shouldn't be talking about yet another unfunded mandate to care providers who are already stretched sometimes to their limits, and patients who are often, you know, have complex lives and busy activities and such. But the, you know, this can be done inexpensively. If anything, we should be learning lessons from all of the efforts that have been made in East Africa that allow task shifting responsibilities across a broad spectrum or bandwidth of care providers. The other thing that I think emerges out of East Africa particularly is this notion of social investment. So the more that the patient understands that there are people invested in their health, the more likely it is that they'll stay engaged in care and the more likely it is that they'll continue taking their medicines when appropriate. The other piece of it is a sense, a bit of redundancy, but again, importantly, engagement with patients. So that these organic sort of networks, if you will, it could be as simple as a phone tree or an email list with the patient's permission that allows people to communicate across that network that says, you know, John Doe missed an appointment or John Doe missed a refill. Can we, you know, do something to intervene? And I've seen this work actually in rural clinics and rural villages in East Africa. If it can happen there, I'm sure it can happen here in the States.
So you had referred a little earlier to your organization's guidelines on this sort of thing. You're the medical director of IAPAC, which early last year, put out some pretty comprehensive adherence recommendations. Was what you had just said part of that? What are the key takeaway points from those guidelines?
Yeah, the guidelines were published last year in Annals of Internal Medicine, and it was the result of an international effort to compile the best evidence around improving both engagement in care as well as adherence to antiretroviral treatments. And there are very specific recommendations across there with grading as to the strength of the recommendation and the quality of the data. I think that, you know, it's important to understand that there actually is science behind this. Some places the science is not as robust or as deep as we might want it to be. In fact, I think it's a bit stunning when we think about the 30 years of the epidemic that we, you know, have really only a few hundred publications that are of reasonable quality on the subject. So that, you know, as important as adherence is, there's room for a lot more thoughtful science and learning about that. But in terms of how do we better do this, our guidelines speak to improving education and counseling around adherence. We talk about, and in fact, ironically, some of the best data on this about the use of communication technologies. That's really to say, you know, using your cell phone and text messaging to remind people about appointments or taking their medicines. There's actually good data about that, but we don't deploy that on a regular basis here in the States. And I think that, again, there's opportunities to learn on that. So the idea is that both at the community level but also at the individual level, there are interventions that can be deployed to both improve the patient's knowledge base about why adherence is important, what kinds of interventions we can do to, you know, operationalize those educational points, and ways to communicate goals and just taking medications or making other appointments. And so, you know, we can improve how those ultimately are acted on by the patient.
All right, so get specific with me a bit here. What are the key interventions? What are the key steps that a typical healthcare provider, and let's be specific here with something that's applicable within the United States, the steps they should be taking that they may not be already taking to increase their patient's level of engagement in care and ensuring that they take their meds as well as possible?
So let's start from the very beginning. I mean, there are strong recommendations over providing education about antiretroviral therapy. There's strong recommendations about providing one-on-one support and adherence counseling to people.
Now, by education about antiretroviral therapy, do you just mean explaining how the drugs work?
Pretty much, yeah. In other words, the better people understand, you know, why they're taking medications and how they work, it turns out that actually helps people take the pills. And conversely, and in fact, this is important data that has also emerged, is that the converse is also true. So that if people don't understand that there's a reason why they take these things, if people don't understand what to do if there's a side effect, if people don't understand or don't believe that medications will help, they tend not to take them. So both the message and the messenger are important. We have to educate people that these medicines work, they are nearly always well tolerated, and they will save your life. If people understand that, they actually believe that, and how to get people to believe it is a sort of a separate conversation, but if people believe that, patients believe that, they actually are more likely to take them. There's a really strong educational component to this. There are also very specific guidelines about collecting information, again, as we've said, about self-reported adherence routinely from patients, getting pharmacy refill data when appropriate. Those are strong recommendations, and those things should be implemented both abroad, but again, here in the United States. There are more specific guidelines, recommendations about special populations of people where, you know, there may be special needs, and it's mostly to highlight the fact that different populations of people and different individuals may have individualized needs. There's also, I think this is an important point that is made by the evidence-based guidelines, that it doesn't have to be the doctor. It doesn't have to be the prescriber that does many of these interventions. In fact, again, strong recommendations says that nurses or community-based counselors can provide adherence counseling even in under-resourced areas. And under-resourced doesn't just mean Eastern Africa. It could mean rural United States. And case managers also can address some of these needs as well. So the point that, although perhaps articulated in more nuanced guidelines terms, is that it takes a village. It takes a village of people working together, each working in their own spectrum of responsibilities to improve adherence and decrease adherence risks in people.
For the most part, it sounds like these guidelines are focusing on the need for better communication within the healthcare community and with patients directly. How much of this is about improving infrastructure or using specific tools to monitor or to intervene to improve adherence?
There is a need for institutional improvements, and some of that has to do with the ways that institutions or care teams communicate to each other. This is, for example, an opportunity where electronic health records or practice management systems may help. For example, a system that flags a patient who misses an appointment or misses two appointments or misses a pharmacy pickup, exploiting these kinds of calendars and or reminder systems. You know, John Smith hasn't been in the clinic for 3 months or 6 months or whenever the prescribed interval was, and then using that to notify the team. So there is some of the stuff that happens within the healthcare system itself. But I should point out as well, though, there are things that actually happen at the communication level between the provider and the patient. And this is where I think that there is ample room for improvement, because a lot of times when we talk about this, the conversation that we have about pills and adherence to other medical recommendations is done in ways that can be stigmatizing and therefore make the patient less likely to stay engaged in care. And to this point, for example, our group published some guidelines based on an expert panel about what language should we use to ask people about their pill taking. And it turns out that, again, medical doctors don't follow the science of psychology and linguistics very much. I certainly don't. But there are smart people out there and literature that actually address this point. And so we published a short paper this year that was authored by Reve Amico in Connecticut that ultimately distills down to this very simple phrase in terms of asking people about their pill taking, and it says, in quotes, "In the last 30 days, how good a job did you do at taking your HIV medications in the way you were supposed to?" End quote. And the words, the adjectives, the verb tense are things that smart people actually adjudicated on. And so, for example, the phrase 30 days instead of 1 week or 1 month was actually, you know, there was expert opinion rendered on that number. There's expert opinion on the phrase "how good a job" as opposed to some other taxonomy or language. So it's learning how to ask the questions. It's learning how to respond to the answers that, you know, there are opportunities there to further fine-tune and thoughtfully and scientifically go about the process of asking people about their pill-taking. And so lots of opportunities, and certainly opportunities to further improve this as we move forward into the next decade of care.
Our entire conversation so far has focused on people who are taking antiretroviral therapy and ensuring that they remain in care and that they take their meds as optimally as is possible and reasonable. Are there cases in which, because of adherence concerns, clinicians should reconsider even prescribing therapy in the first place, at least for a little while? I mean, like, what if a person does not have stable housing? What if they have a substance use issue? Because maybe they shouldn't be starting treatment yet.
Yeah, it's a bunch of really important points, Miles. So, you know, first off, there's a lot more to this than just the pill or pills. And when we think broadly about health, we have to appreciate that, for some individuals, taking a pill or even HIV may not be the most pressing health issue. So, you know, the person who's homeless, the patient who is actively suicidal, the patient who has, you know, active substance use disorders may have more pressing short-term health issues. That doesn't mean necessarily that HIV becomes secondary or tertiary, but it needs to be placed in that context. And so at one level, it means that we need to be thinking very broadly about how we define health and the health goals for individuals. It also means, though, I think important to say that people who are marginally housed or have mental health problems aren't necessarily going to be non-adherent, but the person who says, "I don't want to take pills," is probably going to be non-adherent. So, and that could come from known risk factor groups or just from an individual who just doesn't yet believe that medicines are necessary or will be helpful. It means that we have to think about adherence from the very broadest sense. That means, you know, are people able to get to health care? Are they willing to be in health care? Do they have other barriers to entering healthcare and staying in healthcare, and some of the things we've talked about? Ultimately, I think those adherence at that level actually is critical, and in fact, in my view, supersedes the decision about who gets a pill or doesn't get a pill. So when I think about adherence, I think about the roughly 20% of Americans who are not yet diagnosed with HIV. I think about the additional 20% who are diagnosed but have not crossed the threshold of care. I think about the additional 20% yet who have been in care once but haven't been back within 12 months. And the adherence, if you will, to that part of medical care is certainly for those individuals, but in the community at large, are huge unmet needs. And when we think about this at the community level, we need to be thinking about those patients as much as those who are in care and maybe having difficulty in initiating or staying on treatment.
Sounds almost as much then a mental and psychological health issue as it is a clinical biological health issue, which has traditionally been an area that's been avoided in clinical care.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we have made enormous strides in HIV medicine in the last couple of decades in these biomedical interventions. That is, learning about the pathophysiology of HIV, learning about CD4 counts and plasma viral loads, and learning to discover and find and evaluate new molecules that eventually become drugs and treatment recommendations. We have done a pretty good job, certainly in the early days of the epidemic, in creating community support networks and finding the finances to strengthen housing and food banks and such. But most of those were born and evolved in a time of plague and desperation. And I worry in a modern era where people who have access to care don't die of AIDS and that AIDS isn't on the cover of Time and Newsweek, that the interest to provide the continuing support or integrating HIV care into thoughtful support systems for housing and food security on one hand and mental health care on another may be waning. And those are going to provide very substantial challenges for us. You know, I mentioned this at a conference in London just a few weeks ago that, you know, the leading cause of death in my panel of patients, people I care for, you know, here in a small city in the Midwest in Colorado, the leading cause of death is no longer AIDS-related. The leading cause of death is not cardiovascular disease or cancer. The leading cause of death is related to mental health. And when we look at large cohorts, both in North America and in Europe, trauma and suicide now is the third or fourth leading cause of death in populations of people living with HIV. So that means that we really need to redouble those efforts, but it requires a culture shift between the urgency and the acuity of deaths and illness from AIDS-related complications and AIDS-related cancers, to thinking about a longer game of keeping people in care, keeping people healthy, and ultimately allowing them to return to normal lives and jobs and paying taxes, and that keeps government happy. If anything, keeps government happy.
And the key to getting there is just what, for each person to do their part?
I think so. You know, to borrow the cliche, it does take a village, and we need to continue to keep our eye on the ball, even if the ball is less well-funded, even if the ball isn't quite as bright and shiny as it was in the past. And I think it also means that we need to be innovative and creative. I think many of the solutions are out there, but it means that we can't continue doing things the way we have in the past. And certainly, you know, the prognosis of people here in North America has improved to the point where we are talking about normal life expectancy. And I'll say it again, normal life expectancy requires that we think about long-term health and long-term engagement in care. So to deliver on the promise of everything that drug discovery and tens of thousands of people's participation in clinical trials has offered us is that promise of normal life and normal life expectancy. So, again, to do that, it means that we have to change from an operational foundation of death, dying, and plague to an operational foundation on prevention and long-term engagement in care and all of the infrastructure and finances that go with them.
I think that's a good note to end on. Thank you, Dr. Young.
You're very welcome, Miles. Great to chat with you.
This has been a news report from thebodypro.com. The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us at news@thebodypro.com.